Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
I was listening to our friends over at Reasons to Believe the other day, and Ken Samples was doing a program, and he started out the program this way. What's the one thing you can't live without? I want you to think about that for a minute. What is the one thing human beings cannot live without? I'm not talking about food and water. I'm talking about something a little bit more abstract than that, but something very, very important. The one thing that you can't live without, that I can't live without, that no human being can live without for long is hope. People have to have hope for the future. People who don't have hope for the future tragically end their lives. Everybody has to have some hope. So the one thing you can't live without is hope. Now, the one thing you can't live happily without is thanks. Gratitude, gratefulness. You can live, but you're never going to be happy if you're not thankful for what you have. If you're not grateful for what God has given you. If you don't have gratitude in your heart. Now, this Thanksgiving weekend, what a better time to talk about that and talk about it in both an historical context and an apologetic context. And the man that we're going to talk to about it is one of the brightest historical minds I've ever come across. And you've heard him on this program before. Bill Federer has been on this program before talking about issues like this, and it's a great pleasure to have Bill on here. Bill, I know you've been traveling the country, crisscrossing the country, doing all sorts of talks and all sorts of presentations on American history and the Bible. Where you been lately, and what have you been doing lately, and where can people hear more from you before we get into today's topic of Thanksgiving? If people want to get in touch with Bill Federer, where do they go?
Oh, thanks so much, Frank. My website is AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. Mm-hmm. And I have been in New York, in Pennsylvania, in Florida, just recently speaking at a conference in Florida for the Bridges Ministry between the Jews and the Christians. And mm-hmm. And then been in Springfield, Missouri, and spoke at Evangel College, and then at Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri, and just bouncing around, trying to have an urgency in the inside, which a lot of us have, that things are moving in a direction that unless things turn around very quickly, we may not have the same country that you and I inherited. Proverbs 13:22 says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And mm-hmm. we wonder, are we good men and good women? Because the inheritance we're leaving is not that good. And no. So anyway, that's one of the things that motivates me. And this time of year is always a special time because we do have a very strong godly Christian past in America that people are not aware of that I like to highlight.
Well, let's highlight Thanksgiving since it is Thanksgiving weekend. And let's just start with the Pilgrims. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on who the Pilgrims were and why they came here, and what does it mean to us today?
Well, Europe during the Middle Ages was Catholic, and then in mm-hmm. 1517, Martin Luther started the Reformation. In 1529, 100,000 Muslims surround Vienna, Austria, under Suleiman the Magnificent. He dominated the Mediterranean Sea. His Muslim admiral, pirate admiral Dragut Reis, was raiding the coasts of Spain and France and Italy and Sicily, Corsica, Sardinia. I mean, just dominates. And the Muslims enslaved over 1 million Europeans and took them to North Africa, to the Barbary Coast. And so there were entire Catholic orders in Europe called the Trinitarians, and the head of the order was called the Ransomer. And they would go under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back. And so this is the situation. The Muslims are invading and surrounding Vienna under Suleiman the Magnificent. So the Holy Roman Emperor is Catholic Charles V of Spain. He is the most powerful man in the world. Spain not only controls the Netherlands, Spanish Netherlands, but controls Italy. Charles V actually sacked Rome and arrested the Pope. Charles V claimed all the New World and then the Philippines. So the sun never set on the Spanish Empire. He had all this gold coming in. And from Charles V's perspective, he had a double dilemma on his hands. The Reformation on one side and the Muslim invasion on the other side. So in 1555, just a month before he abdicates the throne, he pushes through a deal. It's called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. And in there is a little Latin phrase which made a big difference. It is curios regio, eius religio. So that means whose is the reign, the regio, his is the religion, religio. So this let every king decide what was going to be believed in his kingdom. Let's just have a united front against these Muslims. Well, this started a domino effect across Europe. So different kings decided to believe different things for their kingdoms. And so northern Germany and Sweden became Lutheran. Holland became Dutch Reformed. England became Anglican. Scotland became Presbyterian. Switzerland became Calvinist. And, of course, Italy, Spain, France, Austria, Poland remained Roman Catholic. Now, if you did not believe the way your king did, you were persecuted and you fled. And so there was this mass migration of people around Europe in the 1600s simply for conscience sake, and a lot of wars and killings. And these were the ones that actually spilled over and founded colonies in America. And they did the same thing. Every colony was started by a different denomination. So Virginia was Anglican. Massachusetts was Puritan. Rhode Island was Baptist. New York was Dutch Reformed. Delaware and New Jersey were originally New Sweden, and they were Swedish Lutheran. Maryland Catholic, Pennsylvania Quaker, Connecticut and New Hampshire Congregationalists. And guess what? They did not get along, and they would chase each other out of each other's colonies. Then they had to work together against the King of England. And after the Revolution, their attitude was, we may not agree on religion all the time, but you were willing to fight and die for my freedom. I need to let you practice your faith. And so this was the beginning of tolerance, which grew after an Irish potato famine. Millions of Irish Catholics came to America. They got tolerated. Then in the middle 1800s, a persecution of Jews in Bavaria. They got tolerated. And finally, everyone gets tolerated. Until now, everyone is tolerated except the Christians that founded the country. So it's backfired. Yeah, but nevertheless, focusing on the pilgrims, let's look at England. So during the time where different kings were believing different things, England had a king named Henry VIII. He was married to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, the ones who sent Columbus to America. Mm-hmm. After 18 years, Catherine did not have a son. Had a daughter, Mary, but not a son. So Henry VIII decides to divorce her. The Pope would not recognize the divorce. And so Henry said, I'll be my own pope. And he starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives. And their fates, unfortunately, were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So Henry VIII was not a really nice guy to be married to. Well, his advisors suggested if he really wanted to break from Rome and be his own pope, so to speak, he needed to stop using that Latin Bible. Because as long as they're reading Latin, they're going to think of Italy and Rome. And so Henry VIII decides to spread the English Bible around the country. A few years earlier, he had, you know, had William Tyndale killed, and William Tyndale's last words were, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. And so they basically recover Tyndale's Bible. It's called the Matthew Coverdale Bible, and they spread it around England. The front page has this nice engraving of King Henry handing the Bible to all the princes and the lords, and they're all, you know, saying, oh, thank you, you're wonderful king. And so he likes it. They spread this around England. But something unexpected happened. People began to read it and began to compare what is in this Bible to this king divorcing and beheading his wives and being over the church. And then a movement began to want to purify the Church of England. And so this movement was called the Puritans. So that's who the Puritans were. They were part of the Church of England with the king as the head. They just wanted to purify it. Well, there was an Anglican, the bishop named William Laud, L-A-U-D, and he would send spies into the churches to make sure the pastors were following the official Anglican liturgy. And
if Bill, hang on a sec. There's always going to be trouble when people start reading the Bible. You can see that coming. We're talking to Bill Federer, and we're talking about Thanksgiving and the history behind it, the history behind our country and the pilgrims, and what does it mean to us today. More with Bill right after this break. I'm Frank Turek. Don't touch that dial. Back in 2 minutes. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. If you're low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. And the truth is, there's a lot of history in our country that most of us don't know about. How did we get here? Why did this country even begin? Well, we're talking to Dr. Bill Federer about that. And by the way, for those of you that don't know Bill, you need to check out his book, America's God and Country, the Encyclopedia of Quotations. It's absolutely exhaustive of some of the most profound quotes ever said by our founding fathers, presidents, statesmen, scientists, constitutions, court decisions. You can use it for speeches, papers, debates, essays, or just to increase your knowledge as to where we've come from. Because if we don't know history, our future is going to be bleak. We need to learn from history if we're going to have a bright future. So we've been talking to Bill about the history of our country. And Bill, pick it up where you left off about Bill Laud. You were right in that area there when we went to break before. Pick it up right there.
Well, the King of England, Henry VIII, decides that he is going to break from Rome and be his own pope. During this time, it was when Sir Thomas More, a man for all seasons, you know, he doesn't want to go along with the break. He's killed. The Archbishop of the Anglican Church is William Laud, L-A-U-D. And Laud writes a list of all the leaders in England and puts an O or a P by their name. O for Orthodox and P for Puritans. And the Puritans were arrested and put in jail, and he would send spies into the churches, so like IRS agents, and listen to the sermons, and if they weren't Anglican-centered, they would get arrested. There was a professor at Oxford named Alexander Leighton, and he felt that Henry VIII did not separate enough from the Catholic Church, and he objected to the continued use of cassocks. And now Cambridge and Oxford were universities started by Catholics, and the they were training schools for priests, and so they would wear cassocks. And the Anglicans wanted to continue this. Matter of fact, the University of Cambridge and Oxford and set the stage for other universities, and they continued the idea of wearing the cassock, and we still continue that today at the graduation ceremonies. And so kids go out and rent the black cassock, right? That goes back to the Catholics. But Alexander Leighton felt like they shouldn't have continued the cassock. And so he gets arrested, and he gets his nose cut in half, his ears cut off, branded on the face as a heretic, whipped twice, and put in the Tower of London until he died. It was a serious thing for disagreeing with the king's church. Matter of fact, you know, William Penn later was expelled from Oxford for having a Bible study in his dorm room rather than going to the Anglican chapel service. And so this state-approved belief system was very intolerant. Meanwhile, there was another group of people in England that said, it's beyond hope of trying to purify the Church of England. We are going to separate ourselves. And they would meet in barns and basements by candlelight, sort of like the illegal house churches in China. Sort of like maybe, you know, and well, I think it was the state of New Mexico where people were having a Bible study at their house, and the zoning laws said that they could have, you know, the birthday parties and drink beer and watch football games, but they couldn't have a Bible study. And so they would get, you know, arrested. Well, that's what would happen. These pilgrim separatists would meet in William Brewster's house. He was the wealthy guy. And the British would send spies to peek in the window and see that they were saying a prayer and reading the Bible. They would bust in there and arrest everybody and put them in stocks. And so these pilgrim separatists decided that they were going to sell their farms and buy a ticket and go to Holland. Holland was the Seven United Netherlands. They were provinces that didn't quite believe the same thing, but they worked together against Spain. And they created a somewhat of a republic, and they had a little tolerance. They also had looser morals, but nevertheless, the pilgrims thought, well, let's go there.
So they still do today, Bill. They still have looser morals today, just to a much greater degree.
yeah, and now Islam's taking over there. But the pilgrim separatists sell their farms, and they buy tickets for boats, and right before the boat leaves the dock, the captain robs them, takes all their stuff, turns them over to the police. The police put them in jail for being separatists. Another group of these pilgrim separatists sell their farms, and this time they arrange for the Dutch ship to meet them on the coast, and they have the men with the rowboats get all the supplies. They row out there. They are storing everything on the ship, And then somebody snitched, and the British found out, rode over the hill and captured the women and children who were waiting on the shore. And the Dutch captain of the ship said, I can't fight a war. We're out of here. He pulls anchor and sails away. And you can just picture these wives on the shore saying, husband, get back here.
Right.
For 2 years, they passed those women and children from one court in England to another. Finally, a judge said, go home. They go, we can't go home. We sold our homes. And so just to get rid of the nuisance, they put them on a ship, send them over to Holland, and they are reunited with their husbands. So there is a happy ending to that chapter. Well, in Holland, they end up in Leiden, Holland, and they have to work 2-3 jobs. I mean, it is very strenuous. It is so tough of a life that none of the other separatists want to join them. And then the kids, now they're 12 years, the kids start learning the Dutch language, have Dutch friends, and then they start assimilating young men wanting to join the Dutch army because Spain is threatening to invade Holland. And so then these pilgrims have a decision to make. Are we going to assimilate and just be Dutch, or are we going to leave? They decided they wanted to be more than just this blip on the radar screen of history. They decided to go to the New World. They originally thought of going to Guyana, South America, because it had a perpetual spring, but they heard of malaria and the Spanish Main. This is the area of the Caribbean controlled by Spain. Mm-hmm. And a few years earlier, in 1565, some French Protestants who were chased out of France after the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, French settle the area of Jacksonville, Florida. They're there a couple of years till the Spanish find out about it, kill the men, and then they take the women and children away. And so the pilgrims said, well, we don't want to go anywhere near where Spain is. And a few years earlier, in 1607, the royal colony of Virginia was in existence. And so the pilgrims decided, let's go there. They tried getting King James to give them permission for their faith, but he said, no, I'm the head of the Anglican Church. Everybody's got to be Anglican. But there's a courtier, somebody that sort of lobbies for them, and says, you know what, he's going to be so preoccupied with Europe, you can more or less do whatever you want once you get over there. Mm-hmm. So these pilgrims decide to go. They get a ship called the Speedwell. It does not speed well. it leaks. So they take it back, recaulk it, take it out, it leaks again, take it back, they sell it for the Mayflower. Now they've eaten through half their supplies, and now it's wintertime. But this has a providential purpose. Sometimes when things don't go the way you want, there's right. a plan. Well, now they're sailing across the North Atlantic in the wintertime. It's stormy. It's freezing cold. They're confined to the between deck, a little 4-foot-high space. One of the main beams cracks, and they have a iron screw that they use to prop up the corner of buildings. They put it under there and prop the beam back in place. One young pilgrim guy is tired of being crammed in this 4-foot space for 66 days. He goes topside, and a wave sweeps him off the boat. And he's in the water, but the ship had tilted so far in the water to the side that it was dragging the ropes, and the ropes catch his arm, and when the ship rights, it throws him back on deck. He's blue, but he survives. The pilgrims finally get to the New World, but they're way far north at Jamestown. They try going south, but there's what they call the graveyard of ships south of Massachusetts, where there's all these rocks under the water and the tide's unpredictable. So the captain almost sinks, and then he says, look, guys, you're going to have to spend the winter here. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't want to get off the boat and have every man a law unto themselves, so they decide to write the Mayflower Compact, the first government document written in the New World. And I've read through every charter of every colony, and most of them, it's the king deciding who's in charge in his stead. Well, the Mayflower Compact was that these pilgrims were thrown in this unplanned situation where they didn't have Jamestown government to submit to. So in the Mayflower Compact, it says, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, it says, in ye presence of God, we mutually covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic and agree to render all due submission to the laws we pass. That little phrase was revolutionary. This was them granting themselves permission to form a civil body politic under God and then agreeing to obey the laws they all pass. And so this becomes a blueprint for the other New England colonies and eventually a blueprint for the U.S. Constitution, which starts off, we the people. We're granting ourselves permission. And the word federal is Latin for covenant. We have a covenant form of government. Anyway, back to the pilgrims. So they get off the boat, and they begin building their first building on Christmas Day of 1620. They get ashore, and the men are chopping wood, building their little palisades, their little fort, their little house, and they're beginning to sweat and catch cold and catch fever, catch pneumonia, and die. One died, two, three, four, a dozen, two dozen, three, a dozen, four, a dozen. Half of the 102 pilgrims die within just 3 months.
Wow.
And so now it is, at one point, only two or three of them were healthy enough to take care of the rest. So now it's March of 1621. Mm-hmm. And out of the woods comes an Indian who speaks to them in broken English. He tells them of another Indian that speaks English better than himself. And sure enough, a couple days later comes Squanto. Now, this is an interesting story. Squanto was the, even though the other countries wouldn't form colonies in the New World, they would fish. And every now and then they'd stop and pick up some unsuspecting Indians and lure them onto the boat and then caught them in chains, take them to Spain, sell them into slavery. And so Squanto must have suffered this fate. Tradition is he was in Spain, purchased by some monks, given his freedom. He hitchhikes his way to England. He's working in England for a couple years. I mean, here he is, you know, learning the language. Then he gets a fishing boat to drop him off in Newfoundland. And then he gets another fishing boat to finally drop him off. That's just 6 months before the pilgrims land. He gets off the boat and finds that his entire tribe is dead. A plague swept through there so terrible that there were Indians left in the teepees that didn't even bother burying them. What happened, William Bradford wrote, was a French ship was shipwrecked at Cape Cod 3 years earlier. And the sailors got ashore, and the Indians never left watching them and dogging them till they got the advantage of them and killed them all but three or four, whom they sent from one sachem to another, making sport with them, using them worse than slaves. And because the Indians didn't like these Europeans who were luring them on the boat and selling them into slavery. Well, one of those French guys must have had an illness because the Indians caught it and they had no immunity, and it wiped out the whole tribe so completely that the other tribes refused to take over that land. They thought some great spirit had wiped them out. So in a sense, the pilgrims providentially were blown off course and landed at the one spot on the eastern seaboard that was uninhabited.
Wow. We're talking to Bill Federer, ladies and gentlemen. You can see he's a wealth of knowledge on our history and how we got here. And we get back, we're going to talk about what William Bradford discovered about human nature and about government. It has direct implications on our economic system today. Don't go away. I'm Frank Turk talking to Bill Federer, back in just 2 minutes. And you thought you knew something about history, didn't you? Well, if you haven't read any books by Bill Federer, you probably don't know all that much, because as you can see, he's a wealth of knowledge on the pilgrims and even the goings-on of Europe at the time, and how the pilgrims and why the pilgrims came here and what happened when they got here. And it's appropriate to talk about this now just to remind people where we came from and how thankful we are that they did come here. And, of course, established this great country for us. We may be letting it, we are letting it slip away from us, but we need to talk about what they did and what they learned when they got here. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about what they learned, particularly about human nature, communism, and capitalism. But before we do, Bill, it's 1621. Many of the pilgrims have died. Somehow, however, they get involved in some sort of Thanksgiving. Explain how that happened.
So the first winter, half of them die, and the next spring, out of the woods, walks Squanto.
Right.
He had been living with another Indian tribe, and his whole tribe had been wiped out. You can just imagine, you know, some Indian coming into his teepee, and he's all dejected, looking at the teepee wall, and they said, "Hey, Squant, you wouldn't believe it. There's a bunch of English people wanting to start a colony on your old stomping ground." And Squanto comes to them, and they are so inept, they don't know what they're doing. And you can imagine the pilgrims, here they are, 3,000 miles from home, half their group dies, and out of the woods walks this half-naked Indian that talks to them in perfect English.
Right.
Oh, you guys from England? Yeah, I used to live there. You know, yeah, I went to high school there. You know,
that's right.
And you know, oh yeah, St. Paul's, you know, Cathedral mm-hmm. and the Wharf Street and all this. And Squanto knows the area like the back of his hand because he grew up there. And so he is able to show the pilgrims how to plant corn, right? You put the kernel down, you take a couple dead fish, put them on top, let them decompose, you guard it for 2 weeks to keep the wolves away, and then the corn fertilizes and, you know, grows. And then he taught them how to take the corn and put it in a pot and shake it over a fire and make popcorn. And mm-hmm. then he tells the young guys how to go down to the riverbank and take off their shoes and squeegee in the mud and catch eels. And mm-hmm. then he teaches them how to fish. And they go, oh, we tried fishing. Won't work. And he goes, no, it's salmon. They're going to spawn. These rivers are going to be packed in 2 weeks. You can tell by the moon. And you're going to have to make, you know, nets out of all kinds of, you know, saplings, twigs, and you'll be harvesting them. And then he teaches them how to catch beaver. And that was their financial salvation, right? Virginia had the tobacco, but it was the beaver skins. And so it took 40 years worth of beaver skins for these pilgrims to pay back their debt for that boat ride that they took.
Right.
Meanwhile, Squanto knows the Indian languages, and so he is able to put them on good terms with the other Indian tribes. They strike a peace between William Bradford and Chief Massasoit, and it lasts both of their lifetimes. So they didn't experience the killings and so forth that Virginia had with the Indians. And so that first Thanksgiving, at the end of 1621, the Indians come with their deer and their turkey and everything. The pilgrims have their puddings and so forth, and they give thanks. They give thanks to God, and they're there for a whole day, and at the end of the day, the Indians roll up in their fur blankets and go to sleep on the ground. The next day, they wake up, and the Thanksgiving goes on for a second day. And at the end of the day, they, you know, do their foot races and arm wrestling and, you know, bows and arrows, and then finally the third day. So the first Thanksgiving actually went on for 3 days. And so it's a fascinating history. At the William Bradford writes that at the end of 1621, they were exploring a harbor, and he says, here Squanto fell ill of Indian fever. Freezing rain had caused the water to get so rough that they had to put in on some island, and they're dripping wet. They try to build a shelter. And he says, here Squanto fell ill of Indian fever, bleeding much at the nose, which the Indians take for a symptom of death. He bequeathed several of his belongings to his friends. And his last words, he begged Governor Bradford to pray for him that he might go to the Englishman's God in heaven.
Wow.
So here he was with these New Testament Christians, and they're living their life in front of him, and he is so impressed that he wants to go where they're going. And so I believe he got saved, and he's in heaven. But a fascinating history.
So he dies in 1621, Squanto does?
At the end of the year, right, at the very end of the year. And then after that comes another boatload of pilgrims. But
well, hang on. Before we get there, let's talk about back at the ranch when William Bradford originally in 1620 tried to create kind of a communal system. And you got this documented, Bill. I want to alert our readers to it. You wrote a commentary last year at this time. It's on WorldNet Daily. The title of the article is called Pilgrims Rejecting Communism Gave Us Thanksgiving. Look that up, friends, those of you out there on the internet. Pilgrims Rejecting Communism Gave Us Thanksgiving by Bill Federer, F-E-D-E-R-E-R, F-E-D-E-R-E-R. And you point out that Bradford began by saying that everybody would have an equal share in capital and profits. There, all the pilgrims would pool all their resources, and they'd all work together, and they'd equally divide it up. And he found quite quickly that it did not work. You write that Governor Bradford describes described in Of Plymouth Plantation that sharing, quote, all profits and benefits in common stock, regardless of how hard each worked, failed. And you write, the failure of that experiment of communal service, which was tried for several years and by good and honest men, proves the emptiness of the theory of Plato and other ancients, applauded by some of lesser times, that the taking away of private property and the possession of it in community by a commonwealth would make a state happy and flourishing as if they were wiser than God. For in this instance, community of property was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment, which would have been to the general benefit. This is all William Bradford writing. You're quoting him. Bill Federer is quoting him in this article. And the most interesting comment that you have in here from Bradford was this: for the young men who were most able and fit for service objected to being forced to spend their time and strength in working for the other men's wives and children without any recompense. Man, that sounds a lot like what's going on in our country now. Not only is welfare exploding, but Obamacare is built on that premise, that young people are forced to work and pay for people who are not even in their own family without any recompense. And then you go on to point out, Bill, that William Bradford found what? After that, what did he put into place after that that actually worked?
Well, just a little background for this. In Europe, Catholic Europe had a sin called usury, and It was a sin to receive or pay interest. And so there were no companies. If anything was going to be done, like a boat ride to go exploring, it had to be a rich king or a rich, you know, Sir Francis or Walter Raleigh or something.
Right.
Once the Reformation happened, the very first company in Europe was the Dutch East India Company, where you, a baker, lawyer, blacksmith, cook, could invest money in a boat going to Indonesia. When it came back full of spices, you would get a profit. You'd get interest. You could pay back. And what if you wanted to sell your piece of ownership in that ship while it was gone? Well, then they invented the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. And what if your ship sank? Well, they invented the insurance company, right? And so they settled a colony called New Amsterdam, which became New York, and they would have their New Amsterdam Stock Exchange down by the street where the wall was. And when the British took over New Amsterdam, that turned into the New York Stock Exchange or Wall Street. So this is an alternative to a monarchy. It's a way for common people to invest and do endeavors and then make a profit off it. Anyway, the second company in the world was the British East India Company. And then the British decided to have a company to go west, and they called it the Virginia Company. And then after that, the Massachusetts Company. And so these had investors that wanted to get a return, and they would have bylaws. Matter of fact, in Virginia, the company went bankrupt. And after 5 years and hundreds of them dying, they basically threw it in the king's lap, and it became a royal colony. So there are three types of colonies. There are company colonies, and if they go belly up and they get thrown into the king's lap, they become a royal colony. And the royal colony is directly under the rule of the king. So the king of England sent over to Virginia a governor and said, I don't have time to rule. You just raise your own money. So the governor of Virginia gets everyone together and says, I don't know how you're going to do it, guys, but you've got to come up with money. And so this forms the Virginia House of Burgesses, the first legislative assembly in America, and it backdoors them into legislative government. Anyway, in the third type of colony was a proprietary colony, where the whole thing was given by the king as property to someone like William Penn, got all of Pennsylvania as his property. Lord Baltimore got all of Maryland as his property. All the Carolinas were given as property to the seven Lord Proprietors, the property owners. And anyway, the Pilgrims had the Massachusetts Company, and this company had bylaws. And the bylaws said that everything would be owned in common, in the common stock, for 7 years. All the property, all the land, anything gained by trucking and fishing and, you know, trading would all go into this common stock. And at the end of 7 years, they'd divide it up. And so that's the background that you were talking about, that they would all share alike and so forth. And finally, with nobody wanting to plant, and William Bradford facing another starving winter because another boatload of pilgrims showed up and they didn't have any supplies with them. The Muslims had captured one of their ships. I'll tell that story. And so they went through a second winter. The second winter was called the starving time. And they got down to 7 kernels of corn per day per person. Mm. And so Bradford said, well, we don't want to do that again. So So we've got to motivate these people to get out and plant some stuff. And so he decided, and this is where, picking up where you said, he said, I answer seeing that all men have this failing in them, that God in his wisdom saw another plan that was fitter for them. So they began to consider how to raise more corn and obtain a better crop than they had done, so they might not continue to endure the misery of want. At length, after much debate, the governor, with the advice of chief among them, allowed each man to plant corn for his own household. Wow, what a
Eureka!
Revolutionary idea.
Private property here, Bill. How did they come up with that?
So each man got to plant corn for his own household, so every family was assigned a parcel of land. And then he goes on to say, this was very successful. It made all hands very industrious, so that much more corn was planted than otherwise would have by any other means the governor could have devised, and saved a great deal of trouble and gave better satisfaction. And then I love this last line. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to plant corn, while before they would allege weakness or inability, and to force them would have been considered tyranny and oppression.
We're talking to Bill Federer. Communism, liberalism misunderstands human nature, and we'll unpack that more right after the break. You want to create more wealth? Capitalism makes it happen. I'm Frank Turek. Back in 2 minutes. Don't touch that dial. If you're low on the FM dial looking for NPR, stay right here. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. Frank Turek, the website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. Happy Thanksgiving this weekend. We're talking about the history of the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving and what we can learn about it today, or what lessons can we take from what they learned, I should say. And if you want more on this, go to our website, crossexamined.org. And by the way, don't forget about our new app. It's been out a few months, about 12,000 downloads now. It has a quick answer section on it, where if you're talking to somebody and they bring up an objection to Christianity, you're not quite sure how to answer, you click on the quick answer section. It gives you an answer right there. It also has all the podcasts, including this one. It will be loaded onto the app as well. So if you have the app, you can listen to any podcast you want at any time. Now, just before the break, we were talking about how William Bradford, who ran really the first Pilgrim colony here in America in the early 1600s, tried communism in the beginning. It did not work. He converted it to capitalism. It did work. And the reason that communism doesn't work and liberalism doesn't work, it didn't work in 1620, and it hasn't worked anywhere it's been tried ever since, is because it basically believes in a flawed view of human nature. The flawed view of human nature that communists and liberals believe is that people will work as much as they can and take as little as they need. The proper view of human nature is that people will work as little as they need and take as much as they can. You see, that's what people forget. And if you give people private property, they will work harder than if it's not private to them. If it's public property, they won't take care of it as well. If you don't think so, I want to ask you guys a question. When was the last time you washed a rental car? You haven't. You won't. You never will. Why? Because it's not yours. But private property breeds motivation, which breeds people or motivates people to make more wealth. If you want to get rid of poverty, you got to make and create more wealth. And the way to do that is through capitalism. Now, I'm not saying it's laissez-faire capitalism. Obviously, there has to be some regulation involved. But capitalism works everywhere it's tried. Socialism, liberalism, communism doesn't work everywhere it's tried. And this isn't about politics. This is about facts, ladies and gentlemen. This is just the way things are. Now, Bill, let's go back to the Pilgrims briefly here. You say that Bradford started to use capitalism and it worked. And they even then sent about 800 pounds of beaver skins back to England to get more supplies. What happened to that shipment?
Well, it took 40 years worth of beaver skins to pay back their debt to the adventurers, the investors that paid for their boat ride. The Virginia colony paid back with tobacco. Sir John Rolfe, when they were shipwrecked on Bermuda, and he discovered sweet tobacco, and they rebuilt their ship, and that's what the play The Tempest that Shakespeare wrote, that was based on that. Anyway, they show up in Virginia, and he plants the tobacco, and it ends up becoming the export crop that Virginia used to pay back their investors. But the Pilgrims had beaver, and so an interesting story in William Bradford's History of the Plymouth Settlement. he writes that they had been there 5 years and they had saved up 800 pounds of beaver skin and they had dried fish and they sent them back to England to pay back what they owed to the investors and to be able to borrow more so they could bring more supplies back to the colony. This is the quote. William Bradford says, the adventurers, or the investors, sent over two fishing ships to America. The pinnace was ordered to load with core fish, which was like dried fish, and bring it back to England. And besides, she had some 800 pounds of beaver skins, as well as other furs, to a goodly value for the plantation. The captain, seeing that so much lading, wished to put aboard the bigger ship for safety, but Mr. Edward Winslow, their agent in the business, was bound in a bond to send the ship back to England, the beaver skins in the smaller ship. The captain of the big ship towed the small ship at its stern all the way across the ocean, so they went joyfully home together and had such fine weather that he never cast her off, the smaller ship, until they were well within the English Channel, almost in sight of Plymouth, England. But even there, she was unhappily taken by a Turkish man of war, carried off to Sawar, Morocco, where the captain and the crew were made slaves. Thus, all their hopes were dashed, and the joyful news they meant to carry home was turned to heavy tidings. In the big ship, Captain Miles Standish arrived at a very bad time, a plague in London. The friendly adventurers were so reduced by their losses, and now by the ship taken by the Turks, all trade was dead. Lo and behold, in 1625, the Muslims captured over 1,000 Englishmen from England, from the different, you know, channels and islands and the ships in the English Channel, and they took them to Morocco. The Sultan in Morocco was Moulay Ismail. This guy had 25,000 Europeans that he had captured, and he had them build him a big, beautiful palace at Mequinez, modeled after Versailles, because by this time, France is making treaties with the Ottoman Muslims against Russia, Spain, and England. Anyway, Moulay Ismail was so brutal, he would go out and have his African slaves with him, and he would target practice on them and kill them. He'd bring a second change of clothes so that when one got all bloody, he could change. And then somebody brought him a hatchet that came from a Portuguese ship that they had captured, and it was all jeweled. And he tries it out on his African slave just to see how well it works, just to kill him. Anyway, he had over 500 mostly European captured wives that bore him a record 1,042 children. So this is going on at the same time that the pilgrims, you know, New England's being founded in America. The Muslims captured an entire Irish village around 1627. The stolen village of Baltimore, Ireland. They came up at nighttime, killed a bunch, and rounded up the whole rest of the Irish village, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. Only two ever made it back to Ireland. And then there was Iceland. The Muslims, in around 1630, captured 400 from Reykjavik, Iceland, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. King of Denmark had to send a fleet down there to rescue the daughter of one of the important people.
And in fact, so, Bill, I think I remember you telling me on a previous program that the reason Columbus he embarked on his mission was to find a safe route to the east, because if he tried to go through the Mediterranean, there were too many Muslim pirates there. So the very reason America was discovered was because the Muslims were creating so much havoc in the normal trade routes. He was looking for another trade route. Am I right?
Right. And it got to the place where the Muslims captured an estimated 1 million Europeans. One famous guy captured was ransomed back by the Trinitarians, and his name was Miguel de Cervantes. And he went back to Spain and became a writer of the novel Don Quixote, Man of La Mancha. So he had been a slave. A poem Thomas Osborne Davis wrote on the sack of Baltimore, Ireland. He writes, "The yell of Allah breaks above the shriek and roar. O blessed God, the Algerian is lord of Baltimore." And so this is what's going on in Europe and in England, in Ireland, at the same time America is being founded. So the pilgrims had to suffer through Muslim attacks and their economy being, destroyed with the loss of all those imagine
skins.
How long it takes to save up 800 pounds of beaver skins.
Right.
But the pilgrims, they did help found our country. And Virginia was an Anglican colony. But Massachusetts, after 10 years of the pilgrims being here, from 1620 to 1630, back in England, the Puritans, the ones who were being persecuted by, you know, King Henry VIII and then, you know, King James and all the rest. The Puritans finally have a civil war in England. Mm-hmm. And right before the war, a bunch of them flee to Massachusetts, and they're led by John Winthrop, and they settle Boston and Salem and these different cities, and a fifth of the wealth of England leaves, 20,000 people. So the Pilgrims were just 102, you know, and maybe after a couple boatloads, maybe gets up to several hundred. All of a sudden, you got 20,000 of these Puritans settling Massachusetts. Now, they're not used to how to have government 3,000 miles from a king. And right. So they begin to ask the Pilgrims, how do you do this? And so the Pilgrims begin to tell them about their congregational style of government. And then that inspires some of the other colonies. Finally, there is a civil war in England, and they chop off Charles I's head, and the Puritans rule in England for 20 years under Cromwell. And then finally, he gets chased out and killed, and his son gets chased out. And then Charles II takes over, restores the monarchy. But in England, they went for a good 20 years without a king. So they didn't know what the alternative to monarchy was, but they began to realize, well, maybe a monarchy is not divinely inspired. Maybe it's just the only thing we're used to.
Right.
And so this began this process of philosophers, you know, writing different ideas. And in America, the different colonies got to experiment. And so we had this experimenting with self-government over here that eventually turned into the free country that we have right now.
All right, Bill, we got just a minute or two left, so we got to kind of wrap things up here. Let's talk about, for just the last minute or so, what Thanksgiving should mean to Americans today. Who should we be thanking in addition to God, quite obviously, for the great blessing he's given us in this country?
Well, I thank all the military, all those men and women that put their lives on the line to defend us. And also thank the preachers, the ones that are willing to stand up and not cower down to fear of man. You know, during the colonial era, they had this idea that when things were bad, they would have days of prayer. When things were real bad, they would have days of fasting and prayer. And when things turned around, they would have days of Thanksgiving.
Right.
And this was in the colonial era. Every year during the Revolutionary War, they had days of fasting. And then they had a day of Thanksgiving after the victory of battle at Saratoga. They had a day of Thanksgiving after they caught Benedict Arnold about to betray West Point. And then Washington is the first president, and he has the first national day of Thanksgiving. And but then during a threatened war with France, John Adams has days of fasting. During the War of 1812, when the British burnt the White House, John Adams, but now James Madison has days of fasting and then days of Thanksgiving. And then it was Lincoln that made the day of Thanksgiving an annual event. And it was FDR that tried to move the day of Thanksgiving to the third Thursday in November rather than the last Thursday, thinking there'd be an extra week before Christmas for shopping to try to jumpstart the economy. It got nicknamed Franksgiving, and many different states had both, you know, the Thursdays, and then some were Republican, some were Democrat, and some celebrated one day or the other, and it became a campaign issue for Republicans.
Hey, Bill, we got to continue this another time, but you just know too much. I'm sorry. But that's Bill Federer, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much. His website, AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com. Check it out, friends. I'm Frank Turek. Great to be with you. See you next week. Happy Thanksgiving. Blessed Thanksgiving.